to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, September 19th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's front page, the first headline reads, Juvenile Shot, Injured in Colville. Investigators Seek Help Finding Suspect by Kelby Wingert. Colville. The Webster County Sheriff's Office is investigating a Friday night shooting where a juvenile female was injured at a party near Colville. According to a release from Sheriff Luke Fleener, deputies responded to a large juvenile party at 2504 225th Street in rural Webster County at 11:39 p.m. on Friday. Several juveniles fled the scene, and deputies later learned that a juvenile female had been shot and was being transported to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center by private vehicle. Officers with the Fort Dodge Police Department located the vehicle traveling at high speeds on 5th Avenue South in Fort Dodge. After conducting a traffic stop, the officers escorted the victim to the hospital. According to the sheriff, the gunshot victim sustained non-life-threatening injuries. Investigators believe the suspect is a male juvenile who was also attending the party and that this was an isolated incident with no known threat to the public. Deputies and detectives are continuing to investigate this incident. Anyone with information is encouraged to contact law enforcement or the Webster County Crime Stoppers by texting LEC to 274-637. The Webster County Sheriff's Office was assisted in the investigation by the Fort Dodge Police Department, the Iowa State Patrol, and the Department of Natural Resources. Next is an article headlined, Coming Home, Art Career Brings Ayala Back to Blandon Memorial Art Museum, by Bill Shea. When Angela Ayala was growing up, she did a lot of drawing. Art has been my passion since I was little, Ayala said recently. It has just been a growing passion that has never relented. Ayala has been able to turn that passion into a career, which has brought her back home to Fort Dodge and the Blandon Memorial Art Museum, where she began working as the museum educator and assistant director on August 30th. She was very familiar with the museum from previous visits and from completing two internships there during her college years. I loved the Blandon, I loved the collection, I loved Fort Dodge, she said. Being a full-time staff member has given her an even greater appreciation for the museum. This is a gem, she said. I had no idea how stunning the collection is when I was in school. Ayala is a native of Fort Dodge who grew up in Otho. She graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High School. She then earned a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree from Grandview University in Des Moines. She also has an art therapy certification. She has worked in various art jobs in Iowa. Before joining the staff at the Blandon Memorial Art Museum, Ayala worked for Momentum, a program in Des Moines that helps disabled people create art. Seeing what they do to create is amazing to me, she said of the Momentum participants. Ayala said the participants in that program demonstrate that no matter what hardship you have in life, the art is always there for you. Her personal favorite art form to work in is mixed media painting. That art form includes at least two different types of material. For example, she said she may get an idea that involves feathers. She will start by putting color down on a canvas and then keep working away with the paint and the feathers. She said her favorite artist is Andy Warhol. She said she admires him for what she called his ability to constantly reinvent himself. At the Blandon, she is responsible for teaching the art education classes and creating the educational materials. She's also responsible for training the docents, who are the museum's tour guides. And the last item on today's front page is headlined, FDSH Teacher Brings Real-World Experience Into His Shop. Kavanaugh passes on externship lessons to his industrial tech students. By John McBride. Andy Kavanaugh said he always felt confident that what he was teaching his students was going to translate to the real world. After spending 6 weeks in an externship program, he said he realized he had a lot more he could be offering his students. Kavanaugh, an industrial technology teacher at Fort Dodge Senior High School, spent 6 weeks this summer working at Poet Bioprocessing near Gowrie. The externship was part of the Iowa STEM Teacher Externship Program through the Governor's STEM Advisory Council. I feel like now I have an understanding of what that industry looks like and what things I can take back into my classroom, said Kavanaugh. I would recommend that any teacher that is looking to grow should they find a place to do something like this. Teachers can see if there's something that's a good fit for their classroom. I realize there are some things I could be doing differently because that's what these businesses want. Kavanaugh said he spent a good amount of time just observing, but he really got a lot out of that. The main reason he couldn't be more hands-on, he said, is because he lacked the safety training for a lot of Poet machinery. He said that's something he realized would be beneficial in his classroom. They have standard operating procedures, SOP, and job hazard analysis, which I had never heard of, Kavanaugh said. Those were the two biggest things I took away from this. I thought about how I can incorporate those into my classroom. Everything's so safety-oriented there. There were things I decided I could do in my class. Kavanaugh said because of the externship, he's putting an emphasis on safety in his classrooms. He teaches metals and welding classes, so the students are using a lot of machinery and tools. Sometimes you look at something pretty simple, like wearing safety glasses, and kids will scoff at that, said Kavanaugh. I feel like I've tried to tell the kids that's how so many accidents happen. I was wearing safety glasses, steel toe boots, and a hard hat, and I still almost ran into things. Kavanaugh said he also heard a lot from people at POET that potential employees are lacking soft skills, something he also is trying harder to incorporate into his classes. A lot of places are telling people, we can train you for any job, said Kavanaugh. They are looking for people who will show up every day and have a good attitude. There are a lot of good jobs available for people who want them, Kavanaugh said. The businesses will teach whatever skills someone is lacking. They just need people to show up every day. Kavanaugh said he's also hopeful he can continue a working relationship with the businesses where he's done externships. He also did an externship with Central Iowa Building Supply and C&S Products Company, Inc. Both of those were week-long placements. It's cool to see how we can help fill some of those jobs, and they are more than willing to help us if we need certain things, he said. I enjoyed my time there. It's interesting to see how the industry is changing. There are some good-paying jobs out there. Some are available right out of high school if that's what a student wants to do. The externship program through the Governor's STEM Advisory Council has been in place since 2009. Nearly 300 businesses across the state have participated in the program, according to the Advisory Council website. There were 77 businesses that participated this year. STEM teacher externs are expected to work for 200 to 240 hours for the extern host, typically starting in June and ending in July, for 5 to 6 full-time weeks. STEM teacher extern hosts are often flexible in adjusting work schedules to meet the needs of their STEM teacher externs. More information can be found at iowastem.org. And here is today's Getting to Know Our Teachers feature, which is on page 2. And today's teacher is Teresa Tooney. Where do you teach? Fort Dodge Middle School. What grade subject do you teach? 8th grade special education. Why do you teach? If I were to describe why I teach in a brief statement, it would be the following. I teach to promote an inclusive culture of excellence through transparency, kindness, and wonder. I teach because our world is filled with goodness, truth, and beauty, and to learn is a wonder-filled experience. What is your favorite part of the school day? My favorite part of the school day is when a student and I are able to make a connection that supports them in feeling more confident in their knowledge, skills, and well-being in and outside the classroom. What are you working hardest on right now? Right now, I'm working hardest on empowering my students to advocate for their needs, both academically and non-academically. My hope is to teach, model, and encourage my students to use their voices to gain the self-directed skills necessary to ask for help in achieving their multifaceted goals. What are you most proud of as a teacher? I'm most proud of being a part of a team that is passionate and committed to coming together to do whatever it takes to promote success for our students inside and outside the classroom. My team actively strives to grow and learn right along with our students, and I am proud and beyond privileged to be a member of the FDCSD team. What makes you happiest as a teacher? I'm the happiest as a teacher when my students challenge themselves. School isn't always a stroll through the park, especially middle school. Therefore, when I'm able to support a student as they challenge themselves and learn more about themselves and their academics while doing so, my heart is filled with joy. How do you contribute to, how are you involved in our community outside of school? Outside of school, my church community and family are really important to me. With my family through our church, I find fulfillment in serving the Fort Dodge community. What are your interests, hobbies outside of school? Outside of school, I enjoy listening to audiobooks, podcasts, spending time outdoors, and relaxing with family. What do you wish your students' families knew about you? I wish my students and their families knew just how grateful I am to be a teacher, particularly for the FDCSD. Each moment is worth the many challenges that come along with working in the teaching profession because of my students and their families. What does Together We Rise mean to you? Together We Rise to me means resiliency. As educators, students, and members of the Fort Dodge community, we We are called to foster a culture that promotes respect, integrity, empathy, and leadership. Therefore, in spite of the many challenges we may face each day, we rise together for the hope of a brighter today, tomorrow, and beyond. You are not alone. Together we rise. Also on page 2 is this article titled, Paying Their Respects. Thousands mourn as country prepares for Queen Elizabeth II's funeral today. By Mike Corder, Jill Lawless, and Sylvia Wee of the Associated Press, London. U.S. President Joe Biden paid his respects at Queen Elizabeth II's coffin on Sunday as thousands of police, hundreds of British troops, and an army of officials made final preparations for the Queen's state funeral, a spectacular display of national mourning that will also be the biggest gathering of world leaders for years. People across Britain paused for a minute of silence at 8 p.m. in memory of the only monarch most have ever known. At Westminster Hall, where the Queen is lying in state, the constant stream of mourners paused for 60 seconds as people observed the minute of reflection and deep silence. In Windsor, where the Queen will be laid to rest on Monday evening after her funeral at Westminster Abbey, rain began to fall as the crowd fell silent for the moment of reflection. Some have set up small camps and chairs outside Windsor Castle with plans to spend the night there to reserve the best spots to view the Queen's coffin when it arrives. Well, it's just one night and day of our lives. Elizabeth gave us, 70 years, so the rest is not a lot to risk, is it? Said Fred Sweeney, 52, who kitted out his spot with two Union flags on large poles. Biden and First Lady Jill Biden were among thousands of mourners, some locals, from locals and tourists to royals and world leaders, to pay their respects. The president made the sign of the cross and put his hand to his heart as he stood quietly near the casket in the ornate 900-year-old hall with his wife and U.S. Ambassador Jane Hartley. Biden then signed the official condolence book and attended a reception Sunday at Buckingham Palace, hosted by King Charles III. He is one of 500 world leaders and royals invited to the Queen's state funeral Monday, along with hundreds of dignitaries, politicians, military veterans, and British charity workers. Biden called Queen Elizabeth II decent and honorable and all about service as he signed the condolence book, saying his heart went out to the royal family. Queen Elizabeth lived her life for the people, Jill Biden wrote in a book for spouses and ambassadors. She served with wisdom and grace. We will never forget her warmth, kindness, and the conversations we shared. One no-show will be Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, whose invitation drew criticism from human rights groups because of the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Saudi Arabia is expected to be represented by another royal, Prince Turki bin Mohammed. As the dignitaries poured in, hundreds hoping to view the Queen's coffin prepared to spend the night outside in the longest queue many have ever seen. Authorities closed the miles-long queue late Sunday so that everyone in the line can file past the coffin before Monday morning, when it will be taken to Westminster Abbey for the Queen's funeral. Family by family, thousands of people kept joining the line around the clock, braving chilly overnight temperatures and waits of up to 17 hours in a queue that stretched for over 5 miles or 8 kilometers. Suspect seriously hurt when train hits police vehicle. Platteville, Colorado, Associated Press. A 20-year-old road rage suspect was seriously injured when the parked police patrol vehicle she was detained in was struck by a freight train in northern Colorado. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation says multiple law enforcement agencies responded to a report of a road rage incident involving a firearm in Fort Lupton on Friday evening. A Platteville police officer stopped the woman's car just past a set of railroad tracks and parked the patrol vehicle on the crossing. The Greeley woman was placed in the back of the police vehicle, which was hit by the train, as officers were searching her car. The suspect name and details of her injuries have not been released. The Fort Lupton Police Department is investigating the road rage report, while the Colorado State Patrol is investigating the crash. Sailor who died at Pearl Harbor to be buried at Arlington, by Mark Pratt of the Associated Press. The remains of a sailor from Massachusetts who died when the USS Oklahoma was struck by multiple torpedoes during the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941 are being buried at Arlington National Cemetery on Monday. The interment comes more than 80 years after the attack that drew the U.S. into World War II and nearly 4 years after the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency announced that Electrician's Mate Third Class Roman W. Sedlowski of Pittsfield had been accounted for using advanced DNA and anthropological analysis as well as circumstantial and material evidence. About 15 family members from Massachusetts, Texas, and Florida are scheduled to attend the ceremony that was delayed by the coronavirus pandemic, said Joe Makarski Jr., who is Sedlowski's nephew and who supplied a DNA sample about a decade ago that was used to help identify the remains. "We are quite excited," Makarski, 81, said in a telephone interview. "It's been a long time and I'm glad to be alive to finalize it." Makarski never met his mother's brother, but he grew up hearing about him. "I remember my dad and mom speaking about him, and they always spoke very highly of him," he said. "I know he worked at General Electric, and he did the books for my mother's little beauty salon in Pittsfield. Growing up, I always saw his picture at my grandmother's house." Sedlowski, 21, enlisted in the Navy on July 31, 1940, according to the Navy's Office of Community Outreach. As an electrician's mate, his duties included maintaining, operating, and repairing the battleship's electrical systems, motors, generators, and alternators. The USS Oklahoma was among the first vessels hit during the Japanese attack on December 7, 1941, struck by three aerial torpedoes just before 8 a.m. when many sailors were still asleep below deck, according to Navy accounts. The port side was torn open, and within 15 minutes of the first strike, it had rolled over completely, trapping hundreds of crew members. Two members of the crew earned the Medal of Honor for their efforts trying to save their fellow sailors, and a third was awarded the Navy Cross. Sedlowski was among 429 USS Oklahoma sailors and Marines who died. Of those who died, 388 could not be identified and were buried at the Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Honolulu. The process of disinterring the remains for DNA analysis began in 2015, and since then 355 have been identified, according to the Navy. Sedlowski's family debated where to have the remains buried, Makarski said. They considered veterans' cemeteries in Massachusetts and Florida, and even considered his hometown of Pittsfield, although there are no known family members still living in the western Massachusetts city. "We talked a lot about it and decided on Arlington because of its prestige," he said. Hurricane Fiona rips through powerless Puerto Rico. Havana, Cuba, from the Associated Press. Hurricane Fiona struck Puerto Rico's southwest coast on Sunday as it unleashed landslides, knocked the power grid out, and ripped up asphalt from roads and flung the pieces around. Hundreds of people were evacuated or rescued across the island as floodwaters rose swiftly. Rushing rivers of brown water enveloped cars, first floors, and even an airport runway in the island's southern region. Forecasters said the storm threatened to dump historic levels of rain on Sunday and Monday, with up to 30 inches possible in eastern and southern Puerto Rico. "The damages that we are seeing are catastrophic," said Governor Pedro Pierluisi. The storm washed away a bridge in the central mountain town of Utuado that police say was installed by the National Guard after Hurricane Maria hit in 2017. Large landslides also were reported, with water rushing down big slabs of broken asphalt and into gullies. Fiona was centered 50 miles southeast of Punta Cana, Dominican Republic, with maximum sustained winds of 85 miles per hour on Sunday night, according to the U.S. National Hurricane Center. It was moving to the northwest at 9 miles per hour. Fiona struck on the anniversary of Hurricane Hugo, which hit Puerto Rico 33 years ago as a Category 3 storm. The storm's clouds covered the entire island, and tropical storm force winds extended as far as 140 miles from Fiona's center. U.S. President Joe Biden declared a state of emergency in the U.S. territory as the eye of the storm approached the island's southwest corner. LUMA, the company that operates power transmission and distribution, said bad weather, including winds of 80 miles per hour, had disrupted transmission lines, leading to a blackout on all the island. Now we'll move to today's editorial page. The editorial today is reprinted from the New York Times, and it's titled, "Urge to Censor is Undemocratic. Free expression remains vital to democracy." Fights about free speech can feel rhetorical until they are not. Here's what censorship looks like in practice. A student newspaper and journalism program in Nebraska shuttered for writing about Pride Month. The state of Oklahoma seeking to revoke the teaching certificate of an English teacher who shared a QR code that directed students to the Brooklyn Public Library's online collection of banned books. A newly elected district attorney in Tennessee musing openly about jailing teachers and librarians. In Florida today, it may even be illegal for teachers to even talk about who they love or marry thanks to the state's Don't Say Gay law. Of course, it goes far beyond sex. The Sunshine State's Republican Commissioner of Education rejected 28 different math textbooks this year for including verboten content. Acts of censorship are often tacit admissions of weakness, masquerading as strength. This weakness is on full display with the imposition of so-called educational gag orders, laws which restrict the discussions of race, gender, sexuality, and American history in K-12 and higher education. A political project convinced of the superiority of its ideas doesn't need the power of the state to shield people from competing ideas. Censorship is the desperate rearguard action of a movement that has already lost the fight for hearts and minds. This year alone, 137 gag order bills like these have been introduced in 36 state legislatures. That's a sharp increase from 2021, when 54 bills were introduced in 22 states, according to a report released last month by PEN America, a free speech organization. Only 7 of those bills became law in 2022, but they are some of the strictest to date, and the sheer number of bills introduced reflects a growing enthusiasm on the right for censorship as a political weapon and instrument of social control. These new measures are far more punitive than past efforts, with heavy fines or loss of state funding for institutions that dare to offer courses covering the forbidden content. Teachers can be fired and even face criminal charges. Lawsuits have already started to trickle through the courts asking for broad interpretations of the new statutes. For the first time, the Penn Report noted, some bills have also targeted private schools and universities in addition to public schools. Even when such bills fail to censor, can easily cascade into vigilantism. Across the country, libraries in small towns are being closed and library staff are being harassed and intimidated. The Times reports that librarians have been labeled pedophiles on social media, called out by local politicians, and reported to law enforcement officials. Some librarians have quit after being harassed online. Others have been fired for refusing to remove books from circulation. The American Library Association has documented more than 1,600 books in 700 different libraries or library systems that have faced attempted censorship. Political factions on both the left and the right are insecure enough in their ideas that they've tried to muzzle those with whom they disagree. But only right-wing legislators are currently writing censorship into law and enforcing it with the power of the state. For a vocal minority to ban discussion of certain facts or topics because they make some people uncomfortable or simply to score political points is deeply undemocratic, particularly in a nation founded on a commitment to free speech and the open exchange of ideas. Free expression isn't just a feature of democracy, it is a necessary prerequisite. Again, that's an editorial from the New York Times reprinted in today's Messenger. Also on today's editorial page is a column by nationally syndicated columnist Mark A. Thiessen, and it's titled Biden's Foolish Inflation Celebration. If you want a window into the utter incompetence of the Biden administration, look no further than Tuesday's celebration of the Inflation Reduction Act. Some genius at the White House decided it would be a brilliant idea to gather thousands of supporters for a big party on the South Lawn to celebrate the law on the exact day new inflation figures came out. Just hours before the event, we learned that inflation hit 8.3% in August, prompting the Dow Jones Industrial Average to nosedive more than 1,200 points, the market's biggest one-day collapse in more than 2 years. Americans learned that inflation rose for food to 11.4% since last year, the largest increase since 1979. Year over year, the price of chicken went up 16.57%, baby food up 12.58%, milk up 16.96%, bread up 16.23%, and fresh fruits and vegetables up 7.93%. The cost of shelter rose 6.2%, the most since 1984. And energy prices remained stubbornly high, with gasoline up 25.64% from the year before, and the cost of fuel oil rising 68.77%, just as many Americans prepare to buy it to heat their homes this winter. What a great time to have an inflation reduction celebration at the White House and to invite James Taylor to come and perform a song partially about suicide. This is your victory, the president told the crowd, adding, and you deserve a huge round of applause. For the 78% of Americans who say they have faced hardships because of inflation, it all must have seemed bizarre and out of touch. Even if the disastrous consumer price numbers had not come out on the same day, It would have been farcical to celebrate the Inflation Reduction Act in the wake of Biden's announcement on student loan forgiveness. We already know that the Inflation Reduction Act would not actually reduce inflation. The nonpartisan Penn-Wharton budget model estimates the law impact on inflation to be not statistically different from zero, while the Congressional Budget Office and Moody's Analytics also found the law would have marginal to no effect on inflation this decade. The only reason the Inflation Reduction Act's impact on inflation was neutral is because the massive climate spending in the law is offset by even larger tax increases, which purportedly reduced the federal budget deficit by $275 billion. But right after signing it into law, Biden announced his student loan forgiveness plan, which the Penn-Wharton budget model estimates will cost between $605 billion and $1 trillion. None of that is paid for. It's all deficit spending. So right after claiming credit for reducing the deficit by $275 billion, Biden announced a plan to spend more than two or three times that amount, nullifying the deficit reduction in the bill he had just signed, and then some. According to the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Biden's debt cancellation will wipe out the disinflationary benefits of the IRA and boost near-term inflation far more than the IRA will lower it. If you eliminate the deficit reduction in the Inflation Reduction Act, then all you're left with is the climate spending, which means Biden's policies will make inflation worse. The hypocrisy does not end there. After celebrating a bill that spends $369 billion on climate and clean energy, Biden left his White House party for Joint Base Andrews, then making a half-hour flight on Air Force One to vote in the Delaware primary, rather than casting an absentee ballot or voting early on any of his dozens of visits to his home state. In recent weeks, climate activists have been roasting Kylie Jenner and other celebrities as climate criminals for flying on their private jets on short flights. Yet Biden took two military flights aboard a Boeing VC-25 to vote. Why didn't he just vote on Saturday when he was home in Wilmington? Biden has spent the past year championing mail-in and absentee voting, even accusing Republicans of standing with racists, traitors, and segregationists for opposing his proposed federal takeover of our elections. Yet when it came time to vote, rather than licking a stamp whose price rose 3.4% on his watch, he cast his ballot in person at great cost to taxpayers, unnecessarily emitting vast amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere just hours after boasting on the South Lawn how he was taking the most aggressive action ever to confront the climate crisis. The whole day was a farce. If the Biden White House can't manage to get the president an absentee ballot or see that holding a party to celebrate his inflation reduction victory on the day disastrous inflation numbers are released would be a PR disaster, then it's little wonder it is incapable of solving the serial disasters from Afghanistan to the border to runaway inflation it has unleashed on the American people. And that again is a column from nationally syndicated columnist Mark A. Thiessen in today's Messenger. Here's the feature story on today's page 11. New model to enlist regular Americans to resettle refugees. Neighbors, co-workers, faith groups, friends form sponsor circles to fill gap. San Diego, Associated Press. When nearly 80,000 Afghans arrived in the United States, refugee resettlement agencies quickly became overwhelmed, still scrambling to rehire staff and open offices after being gutted as the Trump administration dropped refugee admissions to a record low. So the U.S. State Department, working with humanitarian organizations, turned to ordinary Americans to fill the gap. Neighbors, co-workers, faith groups, and friends banded together in sponsor circles to help Afghans get settled in their communities. They raised money and found the newcomers homes to rent, enrolled their children in schools, taught them how to open bank accounts, and located the nearest mosques and stores selling halal meat. Since the U.S. military's withdrawal from Kabul last year, the sponsor circle program for Afghans has helped over 600 Afghans restart their lives. When Russia invaded Ukraine, a similar effort was undertaken for Ukrainians. Now the Biden administration is preparing to turn the experiment into a private sponsorship program for refugees admitted through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program and is asking organizations to team up with it to launch a pilot program by the end of 2022. The move comes amid increasing pressure on President Joe Biden, who vowed in a 2021 executive order to increase opportunities for Americans to resettle refugees and restore the U.S. as the world's safe haven. the Trump administration decimated the refugee program, which traditionally tasks 9 resettlement agencies with placing refugees in communities. Experts say the private sponsorship model could transform the way America resettles refugees and ensure a door remains open, no matter who is elected. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, September 19th, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Mildred Kika Lynch, 93, of Fort Dodge, died September 16th, 2022, at Simpson Health Center of Friendship Haven. Funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 23rd, 2022, at Tompkins Celebration Center of Friendship Haven. Interment will be held in North Lawn Cemetery. Mildred Marie Greehy, daughter of William and Mildred Struhar Greehy, was born March 29, 1929, in Fort Dodge. Kika was employed as a lab tech with the Rosedale Creamery. She was a member of Prince of Peace Lutheran Church. She was married to Richard Dick Lynch for 58 years until his death in 2013. Kika is survived by her children, Pam, Don Peters of Fort Dodge, Mike Sherry Lynch of Fort Dodge, and Pat Deb Lynch of Buffalo, Wyoming. 10 grandchildren and 16 great-grandchildren, and her brother Bill Lurie Greehy. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, and her sister, Evelyn Wagner. Kathy J. Taylor, 69, of Fort Dodge, died September 17, 2022, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Memorial visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, September 23rd, at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, September 24th, at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, with interment to follow in the Dayton Cemetery. Joshua R. Montes, Lake City. Memorial service is 10:30 a.m. Tuesday at Lamp and Powers Funeral Home in Lake City. There will be no burial. For online condolences and obituaries, visit powersfh.net. Judy A. Eckelberger, 50, of Fort Dodge, passed away Wednesday, September 14, 2022, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. A visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. today, September 19, 2022, at Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Burial will be held privately at Memorial Park Cemetery. Judy is survived by her mother, Edna Eckelberger, Aunt Charlotte Schmelzer of Neosho, Missouri, cousins Regina Ungerer, Kurt of Bentonville, Arkansas, Roger, Chris Schmelzer of Neosho, Missouri, Lorraine Jarman of Surf City, North Carolina, Jimmy Eckelberger, Joe, Teresa Eckelberger, and Jay, Erica Eckelberger of Fort Dodge. She was preceded in death by her father, Danny Haar. Judy was born December 3, 1971, in Fort Dodge. She graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High School in 1992. Judy loved animals, especially her cats and her dog, Snowball. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Vicki D. Fagan of Rockwell City. Vicki D. Fagan, 78, passed away Friday, September 9, 2022, at Shady Oaks Care Center, Lake City. Memorial services will be 11 a.m. Thursday, September 22, 2022, at the United Methodist Church, Rockwell City, with Reverend Dan G. Fernandez officiating. Burial will be at Rose Hill Cemetery, Rockwell City. Visitation 10 a.m. Thursday, September 22nd at the church until service time. Palmer and Swank Funeral Home, Rockwell City, is in charge of arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be left to the United Methodist Church or Sunnyview Independent Living, Rockwell City. Vicki is survived by her brothers Gary, Mickey of Hudson, Wisconsin, and Dennis, Sherry Griswold of Lakeville, Minnesota. Sister-in-law Marcia Clemens of Clear Lake, brother-in-law Paul Barbara Fagan of Orville, California. She was preceded in death by her husband, John, and her parents, Claire and Lucille Kellen Griswold. Benny Bittner, 82, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Friday, September 16, 2022, at Friendship Haven after a courageous battle against breast cancer. A visitation will be held on Thursday, September 22nd from 4 to 7 p.m. at Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 23rd at First United Methodist Church with Reverend Luke Fillmore officiating. Burial will follow at Corpus Christi Cemetery. Gladys Faye Hayes was born on October 10, 1939, in Flandreau, South Dakota, to Walter Hayes and Bernice Watling Knutson. She was raised by her aunt and uncle, Seda and Clarence Benson. Her nickname, Benny, originated from her adopted last name, Benson. Benny graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High School in 1958. There she met her beloved best friends, Sandra Thorson and Janet Ports. On September 21, 1963, Benny was united in marriage to John Jack Bittner. Together, Jack and Benny forged innumerable friendships. Benny's potluck club included friends from school and the community and provided her years of memories and joy. Jack and Benny had four children, Jody, Carrie, Jamie, and John. Benny's greatest joy in life was being a mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. She was a full-time caretaker to her husband, children, and grandchildren. Benny was the wife, mother, and grandmother others wished they had. She lived her life each and every day according to God's will. Her generosity to family, friends, and the community was truly unmatched. Benny worked for Brooks Laundry and Wicker Jewelry until retiring in 2008. She volunteered at both Riverside Methodist Church and Friendship Haven. Benny was an excellent cook and baker, avid bowler, expert garage sailor, talented seamstress, and cunning card player. Benny was a lioness and an active member of First United Methodist Church. Benny was preceded in death by her husband Jack, her parents, brother Don Benson, stepdaughter Julie Herdlicka, in-laws John and Agnes Bittner, and Frank and Linda Bittner. She was survived by daughters Jody Coppold of Denver, Colorado, Carrie Blake Lowry of Fort Dodge, Iowa, Jamie Rob Shipley of Dayton, Iowa, son John Julie Bittner of Johnston, Iowa, and stepdaughter Chris Tim Burns of Fort Dodge, Iowa. Additional survivors include grandchildren Jacob, Miranda Feit, Sarah, Gray Clarkson, Katie, Bailey, Brooke, Samantha, Tim Young, Zoe, Yoel Keifel, Carson, Rianne, Jack, Anna, and great-grandchildren Elliot, William, Olivia, and Matthias, niece Shan Ray, and nephew Sean Bittner, and numerous other relatives and friends. And these death notices are in the Laufers, Weiler, and Seavers Funeral Home advertisement in today's Messenger. Mildred Carter, age 80, funeral Wednesday, 11 a.m., St. Olaf Lutheran Church, visitation Wednesday, 9 to 11 a.m. at the church. David Allen, age 82, services pending. Those items were not part of today's obituaries, but are in the Laufers Weiler advertisement. That concludes today's obituaries. Now we'll move on to sports news. Route 66, number 8 Tritons roll past Ellsworth, by Dana Becker. Most of the time, Jesse Montalto would walk off the field following a 34-point victory, feeling pretty good about his Iowa Central football team. That was far from the case here Saturday afternoon at Dodger Stadium. While Montalto was happy to see the 8th-ranked Tritons rebound with a 66-32 victory over Ellsworth, the veteran leader knows the focus needs to be much better moving forward. Iowa Central, 3-1 overall, 1-0 in ICCAC, committed 8 penalties, turned the ball over 3 times, and allowed almost 400 yards passing to the Panthers. 0-3-0-1. It was a reflection of how we practiced, Montalto said. The focus was never there during the week in practice, and that showed up on the field Saturday. We just never looked ready to go, and that was disappointing. Still, any time you can get a win, it's a good day. We'll learn and grow from this. Ellsworth, who lost to number 2 Hutchinson 70-7, took a 7-0 lead and went ahead on the scoreboard 19-17 late in the second quarter. And despite being ahead 24-19 at the break, Montalto went to Zach Marker to begin the third quarter. Marker, the number 1 starter out of fall camp, was injured in the season opener. The plan was to let him rest another week, but Montalto felt he was needed on the field. He just brings such an energy and presence that the team really rallies around, Montalto said. We didn't want to go to him, but we weren't completely happy with our quarterback play. Justin Silverstein did some good things, as did the other guys, but I felt we needed Zach out there for what he gives us. Marker tossed 3 touchdown passes in the third, finishing with 98 yards in the air. Silverstein, who came on early in the game, was 9 for 16 for 116 yards and 3 TDs. Desna Washington caught 4 passes for 125 yards and a TD. Isaiah Haslett had 4 receptions for 44 yards with 2 TDs and a kickoff he returned for a score, while George Sims, Jamarian Wheeler, and Cal Wiedemann also caught a touchdown. Kane Smith ran for 59 yards and a TD, with Logan Williams adding a late rushing score. Jason Murray ran for 49 yards and Jaden Washington 43. On defense for the Tritons, Keontae Fowler picked off two passes with Elijah Graham also intercepting a pass. Cody Smith and Deontay Bryant each had a sack and a fumble recovery, with James Williams, Rex Van Hoy, and Blake Whaley recording a sack. Ellsworth was led by Joshua Bauer, who completed 26 of 54 for 381 yards and 5 touchdowns. Malcolm Gilley had 9 receptions for 185 yards and 4 TDs. Next action for the Tritons will be on Sunday when they host top-ranked Division III and defending national champion College of DuPage at noon. Dodgers capture 3 titles at Winkler Invite. Fort Dodge finishes 2nd to SC Metro by Dana Becker. It was a strong day for the Fort Dodge girls swim team at their annual Gary Winkler Invitational. 3 Dodger swimmers picked up event titles as Fort Dodge finished 2nd overall with 360 points. Sioux City Metro was crowned team champions with 424, while Spencer finished 3rd and Algona was 4th. Haley Vogel, Julia Eastman, and Eileen Fierke all won events, while FDSH had 7 runner-up medals, including all 3 relays. Vogel captured the 50 freestyle in 25:58, which was an improvement over her seed time entering the meet. Eastman won the 100 backstroke in 104:49, and Fierke had the 100 breaststroke in 109:12, leading a 1-2-3 Dodger finish. It was a great day for swimming, FDSH head coach Ashley Beaumont said. The girls swam through some soreness to get some good midseason times. Vogel was 2nd to Fierke in the race, going 109.66, while McKenna Kammerer was 3rd in 113.89, an improvement over her best time. Delaney O'Connor captured silver in diving with 246.75 points. Eastman was 2nd in the 100 butterfly in 103.88, and Fierke placed 2nd in the 100 freestyle in 55.74. Fierke, Vogel, Eastman, and Kammerer went 156.71 to secure silver in the 200 medley relay, while Fierke, Eastman, Gracie Harvey, and Vogel went 144.73 for 2nd in the 200 freestyle relay, setting a new season's best. Kammerer, Harvey, O'Connor, and Reagan Woolridge claimed 2nd in the 400 freestyle relay in 4.14.50. McKenna had a lifetime best in the 100 breaststroke, and it was so awesome to see them go 1-2-3, Beaumont said. The 200 free relay had an amazing swim as well, dropping almost 2 seconds and are just 4 seconds off the school record. I believe that they could break that this year by the time we get to regionals. Earning 3rd place finishes for the Dodgers were Addison Daniel in the 200 freestyle, 2:15.87, Wildridge in the 500 freestyle, 6:01.35, and Kammerer in the 100 breaststroke, 113.89. Algona's Reese Taylor won diving with 318.25 points, and Brooke Ludwig was 4th in the 200 freestyle. Fort Dodge returns to the pool on Tuesday at Mason City. Finishing up our local sports section, here are 3 short items from today's sports section, page 8. Tritons won run in Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska. The Iowa Central Cross Country Program competed here Saturday at the Greeno Dirksen Invitational alongside over 30 other NCAA Division I, Division II, and NAIA teams. The Triton men finished 5th overall out of 31 teams, while the women were 15th out of 29. Colby won the men's team title and Kansas State the women's, as Iowa Central was the 2nd junior college team in both standings. Freshman Hussein Rabi placed 18th overall, clocking the 18th fastest time in program history at 24:49.1. A. Devaney was 25th, Xander Cobb 32nd, and Will Seke 46th. Each week we have had a new leader on the team, ICCC head coach D. Brown said. That shows how deep and interchangeable our squad is. Taylor McCready finished 53rd overall, and Chloe Garcia-Grafing was 56th for the Tritons. This was a fantastic opportunity for us to see where our team sits relative to the competition, and we will see at the national championships, Brown said. I am very pleased with how we competed and where we finished. This meet provided us with a lot of information and a clear path forward for the rest of the season. The Tritons will return to action in 2 weeks at the Chili Pepper Festival in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Dodgers compete at Carroll Tourney. Carroll. The Fort Dodge volleyball team took part in the Carroll tournament here Saturday. The Dodgers went 2-1 in pool play, scoring a sweep over the host Tigers, while falling in 3 to Newell Fonda and 2 to South Central Calhoun. In pool play, the Dodgers beat Carroll 21-17 and 21-17. Fort Dodge also beat IKM 21-19 and 21-18. They lost to Newell Fonda after winning the first set 24-22. They lost the next two 21-18 and 15-10. In the tournament, they fell to South Central Calhoun 21-10 and 21-17. Lainey Mail led the Dodgers with 25 kills. Maggie Elsbecker had 35 assists and Olivia Totten added 28. The Titans took home top honors, besting the Mustangs in the final in three. Next action for the Dodgers will be Tuesday at Marshalltown. Iowa Central splits in Illinois, Champaign, Illinois. Iowa Central volleyball team went 2-2 over the weekend here at the Parkland tournament. The Tritons picked up wins over McHenry in 5 and Lincoln Land in 3, while falling to Heartland in 5 and Parkland in 3. Caitlin Steffes had 25 kills in the win over McHenry with ICCAC teams, 6 aces, while Michaela Perelwink had 11 kills and 4 blocks versus Heartland. Jory Hayek recorded 10 kills and 11 digs versus Lincoln Land, and Leah Jolly had 4 blocks versus Parkland. Iowa Central returns to the court on Wednesday when they host Hawkeye in a ranked battle between ICCAC teams. Now moving to Division I college sports. This one's titled Air Barrage. Deckers throws for 268, 3 TDs en route by Andrew Logue of the Associated Press. Ames. Hunter Deckers threw for 268 yards and 3 touchdowns Saturday as Iowa State rolled past Ohio 43-10 and improved to 3-0 for the first time since 2012. Deckers completed 28 of 36 passes and ran for a touchdown. The first-year starter now has thrown for 8 touchdowns and 748 total yards. There are some critical plays that he makes in the football game that we're not the team we've got the ability to be if he doesn't make those plays, Iowa State coach Matt Campbell said. His confidence and his resiliency when something bad happens, his ability to bounce right back, those things are super positive. Xavier Hutchinson had 9 catches for 93 yards and a touchdown, giving him 5 touchdowns in 3 games, equaling his total from all of last season. It looked early on like they were trying to bracket X in the first half, Campbell said, and you're still able to have him in some critical third downs and some critical plays and great moments. I think the thing I'm most excited about is you had some other guys step up. It was all part of an Iowa State offensive performance that netted 463 yards. Ohio, 1-2, never mounted much of a threat, committing 4 turnovers and finishing with 233 yards, including just 24 rushing. We got behind early, had a couple short punts, giving them a short field, and we struggled, Ohio coach Tim Albin said. They did a good job of dinking and dunking the ball around. Iowa State scored touchdowns on 2 of its first 3 drives, then converted 2 Ohio turnovers into 10 more points to build a 24-0 lead. By early in the second quarter, the Cyclones already had gained 179 total yards while holding the Bobcats to just 27. 10 different Cyclones caught passes, while Jarrell Brock and Deion Silas combined for 134 yards on the ground. We've got a lot of dogs on the team, Silas said. We're stacked. We're stacked for real. Iowa State is now 8-0 all-time against Ohio and 27-5 against schools from the MAC. It's a great vibe, Silas said, of being 3-0, but we're not done. We've got a mission that we've got to accomplish. The Iowa State defense was stellar against non-conference opponents. After allowing a total of 17 points in 2 previous games and an average of 235 yards, the Cyclones permitted only a field goal in the first half Saturday. Ohio netted just 116 yards before halftime. Despite Iowa State's domination on Saturday, there were a few Cyclone glitches. A couple of snapping gaffes, unforced penalties, and a blocked point after kick prevented Iowa State from adding to a 30-3 halftime lead. It was no big deal against Ohio, but a much tougher date with Baylor looms this weekend. Early morning victory. Hawkeyes win marathon game that lasts 7 hours. By John Bonenkamp of the Associated Press. Iowa City. Caleb Johnson rushed for 103 yards and 2 touchdowns, and Iowa endured a night of lightning delays for a 27-0 win over Nevada on Saturday night. The game, which was delayed 3 times for 3 hours 56 minutes, started at 6:40 p.m. Central Daylight Time and ended at 1:39 a.m. 3 rain delays in 7 hours, and we found a way to win the game, Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said. Johnson, a true freshman, had a 40-yard touchdown run in the first quarter, for Iowa's first points of the game, then added a 55-yarder in the fourth quarter for the Hawkeyes' final score. "I've been waiting for this since I got here," Johnson said. "It's just a blessing." Iowa, 2-1, had scored just 14 points in its first two games, but matched that in the first quarter. Johnson had his run, then quarterback Spencer Petras threw a 21-yard touchdown pass to Arlen Bruce IV on the Hawkeyes' next possession. "My heart dropped," Johnson said of the touchdown. "It was so amazing. I was wanting another one." The Hawkeyes ranked 131st in total offense through the first two games after gaining just 316 yards, had 337 yards against the Wolfpack, 2-2, who came in ranked 95th in total defense, giving up 404.3 yards per game. Southeast Valley graduate Aaron Graves recorded his first college sack at 12:53 a.m. Graves, a true freshman, has four tackles on the season, one solo and three assists. Iowa's other points came on two field goals by Drew Stevens, a 43-yarder in the second quarter and a 33-yarder in the third. Petras completed 14 of 26 passes for 175 yards. The game, which was played in a steady rain, was finally affected by lightning in the second half. The first delay lasted 1 hour 19 minutes. The delay was called at 8:37 p.m. with 10:02 left in the third quarter. The two teams returned, and after a 12-minute warm-up session, play started again. 9 minutes later, another lightning delay was called. This one lasted 1 hour 50 minutes. Nevada quarterback Shane Illingworth threw an incompletion on the 3rd and 22 on the first play after that delay. The Wolfpack wouldn't get off their next play as lightning lit up the sky and referee David Siegel announced there would be another delay. The stadium was evacuated for all three delays. "That's a first right there," Nevada coach Ken Wilson said. "First one, we fed them some food. The long one, we let them take their pads off, let them walk around in the hallway. The last one, we knew it wouldn't be too long, so we just put together our plan for the rest of the game." "It was a long battle sitting in the locker room for a while," Iowa's safety Cooper DeJean said. "I was just kind of hanging out." "It was interesting," Ferentz said of the delays. "Guys were doing all kinds of things." The Hawkeyes' offense showed some life after struggles to start the season. It helped that Petras got back wide receivers Keegan Johnson and Nico Reganey, who missed the first two games after beginning fall camp at the top of the depth chart at their respective positions. Running back Gavin Williams, also expected to be a starter, missed the first two games of the season, but he returned to rush for 57 yards on 16 carries. "It was great to see some of these guys back in the huddle," Petras said. "It made us more multiple, less predictable." UNI can't stop Sacramento State. Cedar Falls. Asher O'Hara had three 3-yard touchdown runs, and Sacramento State pulled away in the fourth quarter to beat Northern Iowa 37-21 on Saturday. O'Hara scored in each of the first two quarters to help Sacramento State, 2-0, ranked 7th in the FCS coaches poll, take a 24-7 lead at halftime. Northern Iowa, 0-3, used Theo Day's 24-yard scoring strike to Logan Wolf and Vance McShane's 4-yard touchdown run to pull within 27-21 after three quarters. Kyle Sentowski's third field goal pushed the Hornets' lead to 30-21, and O'Hara capped the scoring on another 3-yard run with 41 seconds remaining. Jake Dunaway completed 20 of 33 passes for 199 yards and a touchdown, a 21-yarder to Marshall Martin in the second quarter for Sac State. Cameron Skedebo rushed for 110 yards on 11 carries, and O'Hara carried 19 times for 66 yards. Day completed 20 of 36 passes for 270 yards with one interception for the Panthers. Idaho too much for Drake, 42-14. Moscow, Idaho. Jermaine Jackson caught a touchdown pass and returned a punt for a score, and Idaho dominated the second half in a 42-14 victory over Drake on Saturday. Jackson gave Idaho, 1-2, a 7-0 lead midway through the first quarter on a 20-yard pass from Giovanni McCoy. Drake, 0-3, pulled even by the end of the first quarter on Davion Cherwin's 3-yard touchdown run and took a 14-7 lead 58 seconds into the second quarter on a 3-yard scoring run by Dorian Boyland. Ricardo Chavez sandwiched a pair of field goals around Rashawn Johnson's 4-yard touchdown run, and the Vandals led 20-14 at halftime. Jackson stretched Idaho's lead to 28-14 with a 79-yard punt return touchdown early in the third quarter. Chavez added two more field goals, and Elisha Cummings scored on a 3-yard run to cap the scoring. The Vandals outscored the Bulldogs 22-0 in the second half. McCoy completed 17 of 23 passes for 190 yards. Ian Corwin totaled 148 yards on 9 of 22 passing with one interception for Drake. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, September 19th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.